start again. If there's anybody who's in the main section, if you can make your way up here, I think it'll be easier for everyone. I don't want to disturb any of the guys who are learning. I'm going to also ask, with your permission, if the guys can try their best to stay off their cell phones for a few minutes that we're going through now. We're going to talk about a few different things that, in order for them to be meaningful, in order for them to get us anywhere, they're going to need a little bit more of our undivided attention. If you listen with half an ear, so you might hear an example or a story that catches your interest, but in terms of to understand the depth of what we're going to try to do tonight, like I said, it might need your undivided attention. So like I said, if you could do me that favor, it would be much appreciated, and I hope it'll help you to gain something. The topic tonight, which was certainly a little bit confusing from the signs and almost on purpose it was that way, and the topic tonight is our relationship with our inclination towards freedom and the need to be part of a certain system, rules and regulations in our religious life. And that might sound a little bit overwhelming, and that might sound a little bit confusing, but as you'll hear in the next couple of seconds, I can promise you we'll be talking about stuff that is deeply relevant to every one of us pretty much every single day. The problem is not a new one. We are programmed as human beings to have a strong inclination to be free. We are designed as human beings to crave freedom. Not every one of God's creatures is like that. In fact, in the Jerusalem Post just this past weekend, there was a very, very interesting article on humane treatment of animals. A lot of guys last week had the privilege of witnessing a shechita, and although that might have been fun, exciting, something else, whatever it might have been, however you felt about the shechita, it probably raised some questions about the schnitzel that we ate for lunch this afternoon. Here you have an animal that's running around, whether it's a chicken or a lamb. You have an animal that's running around one minute, it's dinner the next, and there's something barbaric about not considering what that means and how we deal with it. And there are a lot of people in the world who are vegetarians, a lot of people in the world who are vegans, a lot of people in the world who believe that it's completely immoral and appropriate to eat any type of meat, to eat any type of chicken, even to use dairy or eggs. Some of those people will compromise. And again, this is not our main topic for now, but just by way of example, some of those people will compromise. Some of those people will compromise and say, well, if I understand that it's okay to eat an animal if it is treated properly, and if I do everything I can to minimize the pain and suffering of that animal, then it's okay. In other words, if I use a humane method of slaughter, and perhaps more importantly, if prior to killing the animals, because no matter how humane your method of slaughter is, it involves severing the head off of an animal, and that's not going to be a pleasant experience. So if I have a humane way of treating the animals beforehand, then it's okay to eat them. This is a compromise position that many people, Jew and non-Jew alike, are willing to take. What's the code word for humane treatment of animals before they are killed? So there are a few, but one of the main code words that's used is a free-range chicken. If you've ever walked by, even here in Beit Meir, it seems like an incredibly unpleasant way for a chicken to live, to be cooped up its entire life. I'll eat a chicken that was given the ability in its life to run free in the pasture, to eat what it wants to eat and to do what it wants to do. And there are studies, amazingly, that show, and this was the point of the article in the Jerusalem Post, that when we care about animals, one of the mistakes that we make scientifically is that we project our own feelings onto animals. And studies show that many chickens in particular, actually prefer to be cooped up than they do prefer to have a free-range type of experience. Why do we care about that right now? Not because of shechita, not because of chickens. There may or may not be, I don't know who's right in that debate, it's a question for a different time. There may or may not be animals on this planet, there may be species of being that exist that like to be cooped up. But human beings, if you or I were a chicken, we would prefer to be a free-range chicken. If you and I were such an animal, we would hate to be cooped up. We fear, virtually every human being on the planet fears incarceration. We fear being jailed. We're claustrophobic about being told what to do. We don't like restrictions. We enjoy the pursuit of pleasure, first and foremost, and we crave freedom. We want to be able to do whatever we want to do, whenever it is that we want to do it. This is not a new phenomenon. This is not something that's a result of the iPod generation. This is not something that our generation are the first ones to have to deal with. This is not something that our parents, grandparents, or great-grandparents were strangers to. In fact, the original sin, as it's called in different religions, but even in ours, one can easily accept the fact that what went on in Gan Eden and Adam and Chava's first sin has drastic implications for the sins that you and I do each and every day. It was the model sin in many, many ways. That model sin has to have a certain prototype. It has to have a certain example for all sins that come afterwards. It wasn't just a sin. It was the first sin, it was a significant sin, and it was a sin that was a model sin in many ways. One of the ways, most obviously, so you know what I'm talking about, that it's a model sin, was in the fact that it was just a result of our taiva, of a desire. A person sees forbidden fruit as a metaphor. It is a code word now for things that we want that we cannot have. And that, of course, is the root for many sins. Many sins just have at their root man's desire to taste and experience pleasures that are forbidden to him. Such a thing exists. And in that way, the original sin was a sin that is a prototype for all sins that followed it. But there are other ways, more subtle ways, that the sin of the Eitz Hadas follows the sins. Moshe Weinberger points out very, very clearly what happened by the sin of Adam and Chava. So Chava detaches an apple from the tree. Chava takes the apple from the tree. Now, there were many, many foods and pleasures that could have been forbidden, and many, many sins that could have been committed by Adam and by Chava in all sorts of different ways. But this particular sin, not coincidentally, involved the separation of an apple from the tree. Why does that matter? It probably wasn't an apple. I'm just speaking like that for now. For simplicity's sake, it almost certainly wasn't an apple. When we think of it as apple, we'll call it an apple for tonight. Why does that sin take that form of an apple being detached from a tree? Because as long as an apple is connected to the tree, the apple is stuck. The apple is bound. The apple is limited. And original sin is based on the simple reality that every creature, we said, yeah, there might be examples, a chicken or two out there running around in the barn, but every being, every living entity craves its freedom. Every living entity, from the minute it grows, what is all of the movement of an apple? From the minute it blossoms, it's this little seed, it becomes a bud, it works its way through the tree, it emerges as this tiny little speck at the end of a branch, and sooner or later it grows and develops into a complete apple. All of those movements are towards detachment. All of those movements are towards freedom. And all of us are the exact same way. We are born as an integral part of our mothers, and we crave freedom. Our birth is a form of escape from incarceration. It's an escape from an enclosed area. Ah, now we're out and now we're free. But we're not really free because we're completely and totally, like the apple that's connected to its mother tree, we're completely and totally dependent on the people around us. So we grow a little bit older, and we crave freedom, because we're normal, healthy human beings, and that's the way normal, healthy human beings have been from the time of Adam HaRishon, from the first two people. We grow and we try to detach. We grow and we try to be free. We want to do what we want to do without being told what to do. That makes us crazy. Tell me what to do, and I'll try to do the opposite. I tell you right now not to think about a pink elephant, so you think about a pink elephant. The question is, why do you think about a pink elephant? Because I said the word pink elephant, and that makes you think about a pink elephant? Perhaps. That might be part of the reason. Alternatively, it's a direct result of my saying, don't do this. As soon as a person is told not to do something, one of the topics that will be loosely alluded to tonight is how to educate smaller children than any of the young adults that are sitting in the room right now, how to educate younger children towards a world that is so open and media that is so pervasive. So it's clear that one of the worst things you can do is make it into forbidden fruit. You don't tell a person don't do this when they're 9 years old, because as soon as you tell your 9-year old that there's something behind the door that you can't have, the 9-year old spends the rest of his life craving and desiring that thing. Don't do something makes me want to do it. Do something makes me want to not do it. That's how reverse psychology works. We crave independence and we crave freedom. So how on earth do we live our lives as halachic observant Jews? I've said it before and I'll say it again. Imagine the following scenario. A guy sitting on his couch on a fall or early winter afternoon. That means shkia in the eastern seaboard of the United States. You're in New York, you're in Baltimore. So shkia at mincha time is going to be sometime between 4 and 5 o'clock. Well, that, of course, is not the only significant thing that takes place on a late fall, early winter afternoon between 4 and 5 o'clock on the eastern seaboard on a Sunday afternoon in particular. That is the prime viewership time for any NFL game that's on the screen. And you're going to have the double combination of the kickoff of a West Coast game or the game of the week up in New England or Denver. And you're going to have the exciting end, fourth quarter or overtime, of what's going on in the 1 o'clock games that are coming to a conclusion. So if you're lucky enough to live in Israel and you have this 6 or 7 hour time delay, you have none of these issues. You daven mincha, you daven maariv. But if you're in New York and you follow football and you attend minyan with any regularity, you know the dilemma I'm speaking about. It's rare that a person, it's raring to go, let's go to mincha. It is such bad timing. Never before has so many Jews been so interested in davening early mincha than during the NFL season. Because you just try your hardest to avoid. The last thing you want to do at 4:17 is have to go to shul and daven mincha. Sometimes we refer to that as a burden. I think it's a big mistake. That's not a burden of religion. That's not a discomfort of a religion. The word, and it's an important word, is imposition. That is something that restricts my freedom. You're making me, in the name of religion, do something that I really, really, really don't want to do. Sometimes even the stuff Rabbi Kamenetsky was speaking about a few minutes ago, it's later night in the dorm, and there are restrictions on what I'm allowed to do and what I'm not allowed to do. There are restrictions in what I'm allowed to say. There are restrictions in the types of conversations I'm allowed to have. And so it makes us crazy. It is such an imposition on our basic lives and identities. It's knocking me off the place I want to go and the person I want to be. How does a human being that craves freedom develop any sort of serious, meaningful religious identity? The answer is extraordinarily simple. The answer is going to be, again, we're not going to build up slowly until the last 2 minutes and try to cram it in. I'm going to tell you the answer now, and then we'll just spend our remaining few minutes together trying to develop the idea and understand it a little bit better. But it requires an honest appraisal and an honest rethinking of our entire religious identity. It requires a complete change of focus about the way we think about ourselves as Jews. Please listen to me carefully. How many people here, and does anybody here know who the Detroit Lions selected in the first round of the NFL draft this year? It's a high draft pick. It's the number 5 pick of the draft. Where's Rob Lapp? All right, besides Arye. Does anybody know? Okay, Arye, say it out loud. Anybody else know that? Okay, it's called Ziggy or Ansa, right? Ansa, it's hard to pronounce his name. What college did he go to? BYU. Okay, a few more of you know him now. 5th pick of the draft, he's a big guy. Why was he drafted 5th in the draft? Well, for a bunch of reasons. He's an immensely talented defensive lineman from BYU who has done very, very little in his college career. He came to BYU from Ghana as a track and field athlete, and he was picked up by the football team at BYU, which is not known, never has been known, even when they were national title contenders in the early 80s, has never been known for their defensive prowess. I can't think of a single defensive player ever to come from BYU. If you can't, Arye, let me know later. I can't think of a single guy from BYU ever to come out. Steve Young, Hall of Famer. They've had a lot of offensive stars. I don't remember a defensive player. He wasn't supposed to be a defensive player. He was playing track and field. And he was picked up, started playing by BYU, and he shot up the draft board. He became the 5th player in the draft. If you want to know how he became the 5th player selected in the draft, if you're a Giants fan and if you have the jersey, you know the answer. The reason why he was the 5th player selected in the draft is because of Jason Pierre-Paul. He is the vision. He is the hope to become the next JPP. That's what they want him to be. What's the next JPP? A freakish defensive player who has no idea how to play the game of football. That's what it is. That's all he was supposed to be. Many of you may have read, I have it in front of me if you didn't, from the New York Times Magazine had a profile on Jason Pierre-Paul before last season. It explains the following. Before the 2010 NFL draft, Pierre-Paul was considered a high-risk, high-reward pick at defensive end. Despite his obvious physical gifts, he can nearly wrap his arms around a mailbox. Pierre-Paul did not know much about football. He barely played in high school, and his only season in Division I ball was spent in the University of South Florida, a program with a history that dates back to only 1997. Then Pierre-Paul appeared on ESPN's Sports Science Show. Dressed in full pads, Pierre-Paul, then 21, jogged to one end of the set and launched into 7 consecutive backward handsprings. It was a feat that would have been routine for a 5'4 gymnast, but was made astonishing by the fact that Pierre-Paul is 6'5", weighs around 270 pounds, and was in full pads. If a wall had not been in his way, he could have done 23. The video has received more than 500,000 YouTube views, including, presumably, more than a few by NFL general managers. an absolute freak of nature. But as his coach says, the most startling part is that the 23-year-old accomplished all this, discussing his rookie season, more or less while still learning to play the game. His, Michael Strahan said, the thing about JPP is, I'm not saying he caught us all by surprise, but he came here with a limited football background. It's going to take a while to learn the game. You just can't step in and figure it out. He's getting it done on the field, but truly, I don't think he knows what he's doing half the time. How good can he be? Nobody really knows. Freakish athletes, the article goes on to say, don't always make it. But Jason Pierre-Paul, the article predicts, will. And we don't know how that story is going to end. There's the risk of injury. You could read the article on your own. When Pierre-Paul was asked questions, all he wanted to talk about was football. The kid who never wanted to play can now talk of little ass. I asked him, the last line of the article, how he likes football now. It's fun, he said. Trust me, it's very, very fun. What does that mean? Why was the fifth pick of the draft this raw talent from BYU and from Ghana a track and field star? Why is Jason Pierre-Paul having more fun than he's ever had in his life? Because we are willing to accept restrictions as soon as we know and understand that it's getting us to a better place. If we have a goal, if we have a specific destination, and we understand that just running around the football field like a chicken without a head is not the primary way to be great, then the game of football becomes fun. Then I master the game of football. Then I master what it takes to be truly great. All of those rules and regulations don't become restrictions, where they are pointing me and propelling me in the very direction I want to go. When a person says that he craves freedom and can't handle restrictions, the person is claiming, the person is really declaring that they are signing up for a program that is not the Torah's. They're signing up for an agenda that is not God. The same person is saying, I have the places I want to go, and I will. And again, we have to be very, very honest with ourselves about how often we're saying exactly this. What we are saying is, I have a destination in mind. I have a career, I have a personality, I have achievements in my life that are important to me. And I will tolerate, for my own sake, for my future children's sake, very often for my parents' sake, I will tolerate religion as long as it does not impose itself on that agenda, on those goals. If that's what we're saying, religion will always be the most difficult, bitter pill in the world to swallow. We will constantly find ourselves in that state of mind, of sitting on the couch on a Sunday afternoon, and I can't believe the price of admission to the Jewish religion is that I have to miss overtime of the Giants-Redskins game. And I will constantly be frustrated by that fact. But as soon as I recognize that we have all the raw talent in the world, and that alone is not going to make us great, as soon as I realize that my desires and my God-given gifts are not alone, not independently sufficient to get me where I want to go as a religious person, to have a meaningful and sincere religious identity, then I can begin to embrace those restrictions. The stance that JPP has to go in, the uniform that he needs to put on, the techniques that he needs to learn, the playbook that he needs to memorize, these are all direct analogies to the religious life that we lead. These are things that we require in order to be great. Now, of course, I'm a rabbi, so no one should or would take my word for it. But let's go one step further, and I'll bring you it's not a proof, but I'll bring you an example or an argument from a source that makes me wish we were in the conference room. It's not an appropriate source completely, but it's from a very, very well-known, although hopefully and probably not to you, a very well-known atheist. He's a European fellow who writes a lot. His name is Alan or Alain de Botton. He's a very, very famous in the world of atheists. He is an anti-religion crusader with a major, major twist that I'm going to explain to you in a minute. He is a man, and there are rumors I've heard from a number of people, and you can check it out probably on his Wikipedia page and let me know if it's confirmed or not confirmed. He is a descendant, I think, of some great rabbis, actually. I don't know if along the way he lost his authentic Jewish identity or not. He certainly is not he doesn't identify himself as a Jew at all. He is a declared atheist. But he is one of the leaders of a movement in the atheist world that is called by some Atheism 2.0. He is an atheist that thinks that religion has great things to offer the world. He just doesn't believe in God. I'll tell it that to you in his own words in a minute. And he articulates a defense of the halakhic system that is so true and so profound that it becomes, like I mentioned before, it becomes a complete game changer for the things we're talking about. This is an interview he gave a couple of years ago. Listen very carefully to his words. They're not mine. These are the words of an atheist who is more proud and more respectful of our religion and its demands on us than any of us, or at least most of us, could hope to be. I was so humbled by reading this, by his ability to articulate and to explain why we do what we do. It floored me. It completely floored me, and I was humbled. Here's a guy who doesn't believe in God the way that we do. We'll get to that in a minute. And here's a guy who's able to understand and appreciate why we do the things we do in our religious life. They ask him, what do you think of the aggressive atheism? This isn't by way of introduction. These are his words, Alan DeBaton. I am an atheist, but a gentle one. I don't feel the need to mock anyone who believes. Already he's ahead of half of us and half of our friends in yeshiva high schools. But okay, I'm a respectful one. I don't feel the need to mock anyone who believes. I really disagree with the hard tone of some atheists who approach religion like a silly fairy tale. I am deeply respectful of religion. I just don't believe in any of its supernatural aspects. That's not our topic for now. He's a guy who respects religion and doesn't believe in God. We'll speak about that a different time. At once, I am completely respectful and completely irreligious. What is it that you are most interested in religion? What is it that you're so respectful about? So if you're sitting here now, you're imagining to yourself, what does it mean to be respectful in religion? What it means to be respectful in religion is that let people do whatever they want to do. Hey, I don't agree with Penny, but Penny is going to do what Penny does, and I'm not going to get in his way. Live and let live. That's called being respectful in a religion. That's not what this gentleman is talking about. What this gentleman is talking about is something much, much deeper and much, much stronger. He identifies something about the religious code, and I use that word on purpose. Code not like a secret. Code of Jewish law. Code of conduct. Code of honor. He recognizes something in the essential nature of what it means to be a halakhically observant Jew, and he admires it, and in his own words, he's jealous of it. What is it that you're most interested in religion? Listen carefully, gentlemen. If you listen to the next 3 minutes, you'll have spent your time well over the entire time we're here today and tonight. The secular world believes that if we have good ideas and good intentions, we will be reminded of them just when it matters most. Religions don't agree. They are all about structure. They want to build calendars for us that will make sure that we regularly encounter reminders of significant concepts. That is what rituals are. They are attempts to make vivid to us things we already know but are likely to have forgotten. Religions are also keen to see us as more than just rational minds. We are emotional and physical creatures. And therefore, we need to be seduced via our bodies and senses too. Forget about that second part. We'll come back to it in a minute if we have time. But the first thing he says, all about structure. That sounds like a terrible thing, but it's not. As human beings, we have a nature, perhaps that same nature and craving of freedom, that pulls us away sometimes of the places we want to go. The secular world believes that if we have good ideas, we will be reminded of them when it matters most. If I believe in the value of honesty, if I care about being a good person, then without the help of any rules or regulations, I'll be able to tap into that goodness whenever it matters most, whenever I need to. Religions disagree. Religions are about structure and about propelling a person, channeling a person's energies into the direction that he most strongly wants to go. When you have that, you have beauty in religion. When you have that, you have the end to contradiction, the end to hypocrisy. I embrace the Shulchan Aruch. I embrace the opportunity to daven. It's not an imposition to wake up early in the morning. It's the thing that gets me to be the greatest person I want to be. I have I'm blessed to have many students of different ages and of different walks in life. I can't help myself all the time. I spend a lot of time with the students who are struggling most religiously. When I have guys who go back to America, whether it's from NCSY or from my other teaching opportunities, so I spend a lot of time with guys who are perhaps not doing everything that I wish they would be doing religiously. That's not such a surprise. I'll tell you what is a surprise. Very often, if not always, in those conversations, I ask him a simple question. Forget about what you're doing and what the Shulchan Aruch thinks about it. Forget about what you're doing and what I think about it. I just ask you the following question. Are you the person that you want to be? You're sitting in the big city, and you're working as a professional, or you're in a college dormitory, or you're hanging out on a Saturday night when you're in high school with your friends. Is this the person that you want to be? Are you as successful at actualizing your most sincere desires and ambitions or not? If you are, then there's very little for us to talk about. We're going to have an intellectual debate about whether or not you, the person you want to be is the person you should want to be. It almost never gets that far. It almost never gets, the conversation takes on a completely different tone. Now we're going to talk about, not debate about what person should you want to be. How do you become the person you want to be? If you buy into the beautiful values of spirituality and of a meaningful life, then when we embrace, we understand that we can't get there completely on our own. You're not going to like this, but you need to hear this. He continues and he writes, the starting point of religion, and this is going to sound for a minute condescending, please believe me when I promise you that I don't mean it condescending at all. The people that he's talking about are not young adults and teenagers. The people that he's talking about are older adults, are in their 40s and 50s, so don't be put off by the terminology. The starting point of religion, he writes, is that we are children and we need guidance. The secular world often gets offended by this. It assumes that all adults are mature, and therefore it hates the idea of moral instruction. You all have heard this before, and it has resonated with many of you. If I'm a good person, then what do I need halakha for? What do I need religion for? I'll be a good person and I'll do it on my own. And the secular world says that's possible. The religious world says we're all children and we need guidance. But of course we are children, big children, who need reminders of how to live. And yet, the modern education system denies this. It treats us as all too far too rational, reasonable, and in control. We are far more desperate than secular modernity recognizes. All of us are on the edge of panic and terror pretty much all the time. All of us need guidance to be great in our lives. All of us are looking for ways in which we can achieve the things we set out to achieve. And the binding elements of our life. Try to have spirituality without tefillah three times a day. Try to inject meaning into a person's relationship without food, without the beauty of brachos. Try to have meaningful relationships to people without the brilliant advice of the Torah first and foremost, and the later commentaries developed through the ages on what exactly that means. It is easier said than done. If you want to take a different code, you think there were people who were smarter than our rabbis, that's a discussion for a different night. But most of us are not doing that. Most of us are saying, just let me be free. Let me do whatever I want, and that's going to be good enough. And it's not. It won't work in the end. An atheist acknowledges that. The same way that Jason Pierre Paul has to put on the pads and has to memorize a playbook, because in order for him to get to the quarterback, there's a way in which you harness that incredible, raw, and awesome talent and you make it into something great. That's the way we need to. That's the way we are supposed to embrace halacha. That's what we're going to try to do. And he's only half right, Alan DiBattista. He's right about the essential nature of man. But he misses, of course, the point that we will disagree with him is how that relates to our relationship with God in the first place. Because being a good person is difficult. Being a spiritual person, having a meaningful relationship with the God who stands at the center of everything we do religiously, is really difficult. Our human physical natures are away from something transcendent, something beautiful, something meaningful in our lives. And we need restrictions to make us as great as we are capable of being. There is a debate. It's not even a debate. Nobody else would call it a debate. I'm going to call it a debate. If you ask your average irreligious or borderline irreligious American of any age, of any gender, and you would ask them to define the word mitzvah, so you would get two possible answers. And what difference does it make? Of course, some people would translate mitzvah as a commandment, and other people would translate mitzvah as a good deed. Many people will translate, did you do a mitzvah? Did you do a good deed? I believe strongly that there is something nefarious. There is something borderline evil going on, and something very, very intentional and significant going on when mitzvah is translated as a good deed. And many of you know that I'm right, but I'm going to tell you something you may not know in a second. The way that you know that I'm right is the fundamental difference between a good deed and a commandment, of course, is... What's the biggest difference between the two? Why? Whether it's obligatory or not, or voluntary. A good deed, okay, it's a good deed. Is davening Maariv tonight, okay, Rishos, not a Rishos, is davening Maariv tonight a good deed or a commandment? Well, those two are fundamentally different when the pizza guy comes at 9:57 or you're on the phone with your mom at 9:50 and a madrasa is telling you to go to Maariv. Is this a good deed or is it a commandment? Those two things are not the same thing. If I announce it would be nice, it would be a wonderfully good deed for everyone to go medical clowning on Wednesday, that's a different thing than my standing up after mincha and saying it is a commandment, it is an obligation, it is mandatory. I am ordering you to get on a bus and go medical clowning on Wednesday. There are different levels of obligation. We all understand that and know that. There is another difference between mitzvah and good deed, though. In order to have a good deed, you just need to have some type of inherent goodness. In order to have a commandment, you need to have a commander. As soon as I acknowledge that I am doing a mitzvah, I am acknowledging that I am mitzuvah. And as soon as I acknowledge that I am mitzuvah, that I have been commanded, then I am acknowledging that there is a mitzvah. You cannot have a commandment if you do not have a commander. If I do mitzvos, I am embracing the notion that there is a commander. This is very possibly the meaning of the incredibly difficult statement that the Gemara makes in a number of places, Maseches Avodah Zarah, Maseches Bava Kamma, and a number of others, that Gadol HaMitzuvah V'Oseh, M'Misha Eino Mitzuvah V'Oseh. That it is actually greater to do a mitzvah that you were commanded to do than to volunteer and do a mitzvah that you were not commanded to. Who's greater? The guys who were paid however many shekel an hour they're paid to clean the dining room? Or a guy in the NCSY Kollel from Minneapolis who every night cleans up the entire dining room? So we'd all agree, the guy from Minneapolis, it's not his job, that's extraordinary. The guy from the Kollel who volunteers and the guy who's not his job, that's extraordinary. The guy who's paid to do it, so he's paid to do it. Yet the Gemara says the opposite. Gadol HaMitzuvah V'Yosef V'Mishena Mitzuvah V'Yosef. So everybody and their brother gives an explanation why there's more schar, and we know this, there's a certain pressure that we feel when we're commanded to do it. My son just had the first of his three fasts before his bar mitzvah. Yehuda just had that. So he was commenting, talking to him right after that fast, how difficult it is to fast when you have to, as opposed to just saying, I'm not going to eat when you don't have to. There is a certain inverse logic to it that maybe we can make sense. But maybe it's simpler than that. Gadol doesn't always mean, although it's clear from the context of certain of those Gemaras that it also means the schar, Gadol doesn't always mean who's better, who gets more reward. The path to greatness is through attaching oneself to a mitzvah, to a commander. The level of good deed may even be superior when you're volunteering, but that's not what we're talking about. Gadol HaMitzuvah V'Oseh, because as soon as we embrace mitzvos, that's what mitzvos are. They're not restrictive. They're connections to the deepest parts of spirituality. They make our lives meaningful, and our lives will not be meaningful without them. They are the path to get us, if we accept that that's the destination that we want. If we want to have a life that has meaning, if we want to project to our friends, to our family, to our children in the future, that the mitzvos that we do matter, that the things and the lives that we build, the religious lives that we build, are not empty and hollow and not hypocritical, but they're based on meaning. So we embrace the restrictions that get us to that place. We understand that we have the playbook. We understand that we have the guidebook that makes it great. We understand that this is exactly the way in which we're going to get to that destination. One of the most remarkable stories in all of Tanakh is the story of Devorah Isha Nevi'ah. It's an amazing, amazing fact, it's really not for now, that you have this incredible prophetess who's leading the Jewish people. It doesn't happen very often, I like to say all the time, really only been two female, not Sarah and not Esther, there have really only been two female leaders of the Jewish people in our entire history, and the second was Golda Meir in the 70s, and the first was Devorah in the beginning of the Nevi'ah. It doesn't happen very often, it's a remarkable, remarkable story. The Jewish people are being incredibly oppressed. You can look it up when we're done. The fourth parak of Sefer Shoftim. Many of you have learned it a half dozen times already in your lives. The Jewish people are being terribly, terribly oppressed. And God comes to Devorah and he prophesies it. He doesn't prophesy, he gives her prophecy. He gives her the message, the time for salvation has come. And we are appointing the superhero. We are appointing the savior of the Jewish people. He's a man by the name of Boaz, who may or may not have been married to Devorah. It's a machlokas amongst the commentaries. But the great general of the Jewish army at the time, Boaz, who himself was not the leader, he is going to be the one on the cover of every Jewish comic book. He is going to be the one, and it's still true to today, by the way, that a number of people name their kids Boaz, but he is going to be a hero, the warrior, like Shimshon HaGibor, like David HaMelech. He is going to be the hero of the Jewish people. Devorah comes, she summons Barak, and she tells him that he is going to be the hero. And he says no. He says to Devorah, incredibly, he says, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it unless you come with me. According to some, it was because of their relationship. According to others, Boaz was exceedingly humble. He didn't think he was capable of such greatness. And he didn't think salvation was going to come from him. He didn't think he was worthy. And therefore, he wanted the great prophetess with all of her merits to join him in the battle, or else he thought he was going to be annihilated because there was no way that God would bring about salvation through him, a level of humility that we should all be afraid of because it's not what God wants from us. He wants us to be great. But for whatever reason, Devorah says no. Barak says no. He says, I'm not going to go. I'm not going to go unless you come with us. I'm not going to go unless you lead us. Incredibly, Devorah's response to that is not to yell at him. Devorah's response to that is not to chastise him. Devorah's response is not to go to plan B. Devorah says, Haloch eleich imach. I will surely go with you. It's true. I agree. I will follow what you want. And then she says the following words, listen to them carefully. Efes, ki lo siyat tefartecha ala derech asher atoholech. But you are choosing a path that you think is the path of least resistance. You are choosing a way that you think will get you to where you want to go. And I can promise you, ki lo siyat tefartecha ala derech asher atoholech. There will not be glory on the road that you are choosing right now. It will not get you to where you want to go. You think there is a shortcut. It's true, it feels good to sleep a few more hours. Why can't I say and do whatever I want? I'm still at the same morning shir the next day. Ki lo siyat tefartecha ala derech asher atoholech. I once taught, I hate to tell this, but to ruin the mood a little bit. But there's a word, there were many ways to say, however, there's not going to be glory. One of the strongest words to use for that is Efes. Efes doesn't, avo means but. Avo means however. Efes means something else entirely. It means a monumental exception to what we were saying before. I made the mistake when I was teaching an MTA to explain this. And again, I apologize for this diversion. When I was teaching an MTA very, very early in my teaching career, I was teaching that idea, and instead of using the word however, I kept on using the word but. And I said in Tanakh, there are buts, and there are really, really big avos. They're really big. I was going on for about 5 minutes. They had so many questions. Can you repeat that again, Rabbi? Yes, you're getting it. I'm going to repeat it again. Sometimes the Torah says but, and sometimes the Torah says really, really big. And it was going on and on like that for a while until I finally realized that nobody was listening to anything I was saying, and they were just trying to get me to say it again and again. It's true. There are howevers, and there are really, really big howevers in Tanakh. Efes is the way the Torah says Tanakh describes when it wants to give you a radical change. This is a monumental exception. This is a huge however. However, we are making choices all of the time. And when we embrace a certain type of freedom, thinking it's going to bring us happiness, it's really an end game for something that we may not be choosing at all. We think it's a shortcut and it's just getting us lost. Halacha says if you want to be good, if you want to be great, embrace the wisdom of Chazal. Embrace the restrictions and limitations. No, it's not easy to be great and religious. It doesn't happen. The general wisdom and instinct that we have are not always healthy. We need help. In order to have Kedusha in our beds at night, we need Kriya Shema Alamita. In order to relate to God, we need to put ourselves in a shul and open up a siddur. It's not optional. The reason why it's there is because those are the system. That is the way in which we become great in relating to God, in relating to our fellow man. That's what religion gives to us. Certainly when it comes to our ultimate relationship with God, and even when it comes to our relationship with man. We can't be great without it. We don't end up being the people. That's the moral of the story of Boaz. You don't get to be the person that you think you are, that you wish to be. That's not the way it works. We are the people we choose to be. We are the people that we end up deciding to be based on those actions that we do. We don't get judged on what we thought was important to be or how we wanted to get there. And we can't do it on our own. Halacha helps us. We should view the siddur. How many of us view our tefillin as a burden or imposition? And how many of us view our tefillin as the vehicle that gets us to the place we want to go? The entire perspective is wrong. Tefillin are the most valuable. Yeah, we know our parents maybe gave us a speech phone, costs a lot of money. It costs more than an iPod, so don't lose it. Forget about how much it costs. Forget about how much you have to pay to replace the parents' tefillin. I can't relate to God without my tefillin. We don't know how to do that exactly, so that's a discussion for a different time. I play better in terms of my mentality on the court when I'm wearing a pair of tzitzis. I don't wear tzitzis when I play ball. You don't have to wear tzitzis when you play ball. There are different opinions about it. But those who do wear tzitzis when they play ball, because I can't play ball the way I need to play if I'm not. We don't have a pair of sneakers that we feel the same way about. We don't have a wristband that we feel the same way about it. So we can't feel that way about a pair of tzitzis. We can't feel that way about a pair of tefillin. These are things we need to get to the places that we want to go. I had a student a number of years ago who had he was older already. He was in the first years of his marriage. And he had an incredibly intense and important halachic question that he was not an impartial observer to. He was desperate. I'm not going to go into any of the particulars, both that shouldn't be revealed to who I'm talking about, in case any of you know the family or anything like that, and also because they're not really important. But he was desperate for a particular type of answer. He also was a bit of a Baal Tshuva. He had been new to Halacha Judaism. He grew up in a very modern, emphasized the modern Orthodox home, without a lot of connection to Halacha, and he had only for a period of a very few short years had been really trying to keep Halacha as carefully as possible. And he called me up and he told me the parameters of the question, and it was a very, very Supreme Court type of question in his personal life, and he was desperate for a particular answer. He was desperate to get the answer that he wanted. I told him, of course, I wasn't the right person to ask. I directed the people that he should ask. And he went and he told me he couldn't ask. He didn't feel comfortable. He asked me if I could ask his intermediary. I told him I would. I got the answer that he didn't want. I called him up. I remember I was driving someone, I don't remember who, to the airport. I'd already made Aliyah. I was driving back to Ben-Gurion Airport, and I had to drive off the side of the road just to have the conversation with him. And I told him, yeah, I spoke to the rabbi. It's not the answer that you wanted. He hung up on me. He was so disappointed. He was so upset. He had so much riding in his life on getting this particular answer. He didn't get the answer that he wanted in terms of halacha, and he hung up on me. I myself was pretty upset, more because of his reaction than because of the news, but I felt terrible about the whole situation. And he called back the next night and he apologized. And I'm sorry, I hung up on you. I was very upset. It was a lot to deal with. It was a lot to cope with, and I just needed to get off the phone and try to deal with it on my own. He said, do you know that when I hung up the phone, I had two competing reactions that were as strong as anything I've ever felt in my life. The first was incredible disappointment and frustration with religion. Here I am trying to do something. Here I am trying to be great. Here I am doing my best with a lot of sacrifice. And this is God's response. I have to give up even more. And I have to be even more frustrated. I was so angry, I was so bitter, I was so frustrated, and that's the reaction that made me hang up the phone. But he said to me, and you learn from your students more than you learn from anyone else, I'll never forget it. He said to me, I had the most awesome respect for the integrity of halacha. Because I didn't want a system that just gives me, I never respected halacha more than that moment when you gave me the bad news. I never respected a halacha that has values that is going to push me in a direction. If your teeth are crooked, you don't want to put on flexible braces that don't redirect your teeth and cause you any discomfort or pain. You need to put on the braces that are going to direct you in the direction that you ultimately want your teeth to go. You don't want a coach who's going to tell you to do whatever you want. You want a coach who's going to make you sweat and to put you in pain. You want a halakhic system that is not completely flexible to your whims and desires, but a halakhic system that will make you great. You want to embrace every single restriction and every single commandment, because it allows you, in a world that has gone mad, in a world that insists that we're nothing but physical creatures, that denies us our own spiritual legacy, it allows us to connect to God. You're going to try to take away mincha from me even on a Sunday afternoon. I won't do it, because that's what I need in order to be great. I need at that moment to remember what's most important in my life, and I need to connect to God at the times that I might forget it the most. You're going to try to take away my tefillin from me. You're going to try to take away my tefillah from me. You're going to try to take away Shabbos from me. I won't do it, because those are the things that are going to make me great. Are they going to ultimately, you remember what Jason Pierre-Paul said, I'm having more fun than ever in my life. Driving around and running around in the park and grabbing people and throwing them to the ground, that's fun. But being the best defensive lineman in the NFL, that's awesome. That's real. And how do you do that? By restricting yourself. By limiting yourself. By saying, I'm not going to do whatever I feel like. I'm going to be guided and directed towards greatness. This, as I said, it requires a brand new perspective in the way we lead our lives. We have choices to make, and the first choice is to make, what do we want to be? Do we want to be great religiously? Do we want to have, forget about being great religiously, do we want to have a meaningful religious existence? Do we want to give over to our children before we get to our children? Do we want to give over to our parents and friends? Explain to them that we have something of meaning and something real. Then we need to make choices. And we need to accept the gentle guidance of halacha and the restrictions of a Jewish life that allow us to make us great. We all need that guidance and help in order to achieve the things we want to achieve. And that's the beauty, that's the system that we are meant to embrace and the system that we are meant to appreciate. We don't have time for questions now. If you have any questions or follow-up that you'd like to have privately, I'm more than happy to do it. We're going to continue with Rabbi Sabolovsky in here right now, and Rabbi Leibowitz is going to be in the conference room. Both of those will start in 2 or 3 minutes.